From Washington, D.C., you are listening to Rule of Law Albania with Albi Cela.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this third episode of Rule of Law Albania. I am your host, Albi Cela, and in this episode, my guest is Pedro Pizano, which is a friend, a colleague, and I could even say a mentor of mine. He currently is the Northwestern McCain Public Interest Legal Fellow at the McCain Institute for International Leadership here in Washington, D.C. Pedro is a critic, a human rights advocate, and he has a particular interest on international human rights law, transnational justice, and the rule of law. His opinions and bylines have appeared in some of the most prestigious press outlets, such as The Economist, Forbes, and the BBC. With Pedro today, we are going to discuss on a topic of particular interest for both of us, which is press freedom, and in particular, press freedom in Albania. A few weeks ago, we co-authored an op-ed at Balkan Insight and Exit News in Tirana on the press freedom in Albania. For those interested, you can find the link of the op-ed at the description section of this episode. I believe that Pedro's opinion, thoughts, and recommendations will be very helpful for the civil society and journalists in raising awareness on the importance of press freedom in the development of democracy, rule of law, and good governance. Pedro, welcome and thank you for joining me today in this episode of Rule of Law Albania.
Thank you for having me, Albi.
So, Pedro, let's jump right in. So what is happening with the press freedom in Albania? So we are 30 years from the fall of communism. It looks like the press is under attack more than ever. You have a government that slanders journalists, calling them trash cans and other names, a rise of physical attacks against journalists, and recently an attempt to pass a law which would muzzle the press once and for all. Do you believe it has to do with the unrise trend of governments attacking the press? And by this, I refer to Trump's rhetoric.
Albi, I think there's a lot in that question. I would start first by looking a little bit about the indices we have on press freedom. So in the last Reporters Without Borders, Albania ranked 82nd in the World Press Freedom Index. And I looked it up back to 2011. And Albania in 2011 was 96. So in one way, you could argue that Albania has improved, but at the same time, it's dropped 7 positions compared to the 2017 and 2018 World Press Freedom Index. So the question is both based on history and culture, and also how these indices work. But nevertheless, as you say, there have been some very recent examples, some very worrisome rhetoric from Eddie Rama, and there's been a rise of physical attacks. So I just wanted to start by mentioning that you and I wrote a fantastic article together, and it's been a continuation of an interest I had on press freedom around the world. This article was published in 4 places. It was even published in Italian. And with your help, we've been reviewing this, and in one report that I saw that you put together, we counted 14 different examples, we categorized them, or you categorized them, in 4 bins. So I'm happy to go through some of those examples, but at the same time, I also want to be careful and conscientious of the fact that these journalists are currently, most of them, in Albania, and it is not only our interest in reporting them, we must also take care of their safety. So
exactly.
I defer to you into which of these examples we would like to discuss, because I think it's important to get an accurate view and a specific view of what is actually happening. I think we could start by talking about the smears, which are public. And as you said, Eddie Rama called the media garbage bins. And so this, as you say, it's part of this populist rhetoric that's around the world, coming from Trump and others. But it's not only on the right, it's also on the left. Such in Brazil when Dilma Rousseff was there, in Argentina, with former president, now vice president, Cristina Kirchner. In Ecuador, Correa sued a journalist for $42 million because the journalist disagreed with his policies. So this is a tactic that all wannabe authoritarians And even some democratically elected leaders who just want to, rally their base. So there's a lot in there. So again, I defer to you. Maybe we can speak about the two public examples that we talked about in the article, since those are public and those were the ones of Krasta and Unexposed.
Yes. Well, with Krasta, it was it is a ongoing thing. It started back in 2017, I believe, with Adi Krasta. That was the first time that his show was closed, back in 2017 when he was at Top Channel TV. So he was fired and his TV show was closed without any warning by his supervisors. And then he moved on to another TV channel where he kept, let's say, attacking the government. And it was a monologue of his in August, actually, that brought him down. Like, the TV News 24 decided to fire him and also close his show, along with the Unexposed one of Ilir Akhipi. And both of them were, let's say, the harshest critics of the government. So that makes sense why the government attacked. Well, it's not that the government directly attacked them, but I guess there was some sort of pressure from the government to the TV channel to close their shows and to fire them. Well, so that's how it goes. But what worries me the most right now in Albania, because let's face it, it is sad to say that in Albania we're used to these news of journalists being fired.
But before you go on, if I may interrupt, just to complete that story of Krasta, because then that was reported to the Council of Europe.
Yes.
And we're still awaiting a reply. And of course, the issue that you mentioned there is the issue that is important, because a private TV station, such as I understand News 24, can fire journalists for any reason, for business purpose, as long as they're not doing it for discriminatory purposes. The question is whether there's government pressure to punish these journalists for critical views, either by pressuring the leaders to fire these journalists or by fining them. So hopefully the Council of Europe gets back to us and we get some more information about exactly this happens. But most observers, as far as we know, do think that this was because of his criticisms against the government. And it's also a pattern with these other 12 examples that we've looked at.
Well, facts indicate that actually it was political, because, for example, with the Unexposed TV show with a TV host at the Unexposed, Ilir Akhipi. So it makes sense that it's political, because Ilir Akhipi was already in a lawsuit with the prime minister.
Right.
So he kept attacking the government. So it makes sense that his show was closed for political reasons. The same with Krasta, because his show was closed immediately after he released a monologue, a very powerful monologue, in which he attacked the government and the policies of the government.
Right, yeah, that we just must be careful, because, for example, I was born in Colombia, and just now the leading magazine fired their leading columnist because the columnist was attacking the magazine itself where it published, and it was criticizing it for allegedly holding back some documents. And this has been like a two-year media craze, and everyone goes back and forth, and they finally fired him for the second time. And at the same time, he was very critical of the current government. So some people think that he was fired because this group is more allied with the government, and that's why they hired him. But to make a connection that it was government pressure would be very tenuous in the Colombian case. So I think one must be very careful, because at the same time, one must preserve the liberty of private organizations.
Yeah, of course.
To do that. But again, I think the pattern holds up, and I think you were referring to the Rakipi lawsuit by Prime Minister Edi Rama, which I understand was he was seeking $9,000 in compensation.
Yes.
And then Rakipi launched a counterclaim seeking $16,000 in compensation. And so while that was happening, his show was canceled. And those fines seem very high, and we can talk about those later in the fourth bucket we identified, with which was the anti-defamation package.
Yes. So I want to talk a little about the law.
Right.
So the anti-defamation law, as they refer it to in Albania. So just for a background, this law was proposed by the Prime Minister in early 2018 and eventually was adopted by the Parliament in late December of 2019, allegedly as a response to the spread of defamation and fake news. But the law was largely criticized by international watchdogs, including the COE, OSCE, EP, and several NGOs around the world. So in the absence of a constitutional court in Albania back at the time to review the law, the Council of Europe called upon the Venice Commission to review the constitutionality and compliance of the law with international standards. However, due to the COVID pandemic situation, the Commission won't be able to come up with a decision. The thing is that the Albanian government insists that the law is in accordance with international law, with the standards, international human rights law standards. So in the current draft, we have identified together three main components, which are very concerning. So first is the fact that the regulatory body is elected by the parliament, opening it to political influence. Second, that the law is quite vague on some parts. And third, that the fines imposed by the law are excessive and not proportionate. And let's not forget the fact that an interested party can also file a lawsuit against a journalist under the criminal code for defamation, which means it would be a double punishment for a press outlet or a journalist. So speaking in terms of international press freedom standards, what is wrong with these elements?
So there's at least three standards and maybe five, depending on how you count them. So the three would be the American standard, the European standard, and the former Soviet Union standard, which made its way into a lot of international instruments. And I say five because there is also the Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the ICCPR 19 and 20, the articles, and there's also the European Convention, there's also the American Convention. So depending on how you count them, there's a wide variety of standards. The most sophisticated one, it seems, is that one of the ICCPR, which has been examined in General Comment 34. But let's talk a little bit about the history. And here I was going to make reference to a fantastic podcast, which is the Clear and Present Danger podcast by Jacob Machangama, which examines this history of free speech. And he talks a little bit, I think it's episode 40, about the fight for free speech that was very in the throes of the Universal Declaration in 1946, and how the Soviets, for example, which at that point, I don't know exactly when, were occupying Albania, wanted to criminalize all allusions to fascist rhetoric. And so they wanted to criminalize any expression by any person or any media that supported fascism. And of course, after the World War, that was a very worrying concern, but the Soviet Union took it too far because it said at that point, and it's on record, and if you go see the episode, Jacob reads the quotes from the drafting history, and they say the fascists are those of the Third Reich, but also all the capitalist economies of the West, and we must condemn anyone who supports any of these ideas. And so, as you know, Article 19 of the UNHR, of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, is basically limitless or absolute. All it says, I'm going to read it, is everyone has the right of freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers. There's no caveats, there's no exceptions, there's nothing. Of course, it's not binding, and the fight between those three standards, the American, the European, and the former Soviet, would clash in the next 20 years and still clash today, and it's sort of what's happening in Albania as well. For example, in the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination by State Parties, the Soviet Union again tried to put in their wording and they sort of succeeded. Then they mostly succeeded, or afterwards with the OIC, the Organization of Islamic States, to criminalize any defamation of religion. And when they got to the ICCPR, which is the first of these binding instruments, the other one is the one on economic and social rights, this one on civil and political rights.
The Bill of Rights, yeah.
It's International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights. And now, finally, the Soviet Union has learned its lesson and dialed it back and was able to include a lot of caveats to freedom of expression. And this was helped by the European standard, because the European standard, having followed both world wars, was very wary of anyone who incited war. So Article 20 of that says explicitly that any propaganda for war shall be prohibited by law. And as you know, today, a lot of countries in Europe, different to the United States, criminalize any Holocaust denial because of this. So the United States is an outlier on that, and that hate speech in the United States is not prohibited. We'll get into the 7 or 9 or 5 categories of speech that is prohibited in the United States a little bit later. But let's talk specifically about one standard that of the ICCPR Article 19 and 20 is applied to the anti-defamation law, which, just for reference sake, is Law 91 of 2019 that amends Law 97 of 2013.
Exactly.
And that establishes the three things that you said, or the three things we found that there were, in the vagueness of its standard, the unelected or the unaccountable body that decides, and the exorbitant fines. So,
So before you jump in, let me just give some feedback on these three elements to why they are concerning for us. So with regard to AMA, which is the Albanian Media Authority, so the members of the AMA are directly elected by the parliament, which right now can decide on any matter with the sole votes of the ruling party, who currently has 70% of the seats in the parliament. That's what makes it to worry about. So this increases the risk of AMA being influenced by the government. Well, the decision of the AMA can be overruled by a court of law, according to the latest changes in the law, because the OSCE pushed to the government. However, the decision of the AMA would still be in force until the court would render a final decision. And this could take months or even years, considering the situation of the judiciary in Albania, as we have talked about it. So with regard to the vagueness, in particular in Article 33 of the law, it provides that the press should announce and present information in a genuine, impartial, and objective way. Well, these are really vague terms. Like, how can one say that what is genuine, what is impartial, and what is objective, especially a state agency? That's what worries us.
Yeah, and on top of that, the fines, right? Because that AMA can also impose fines that are very exorbitant. So we made the calculation in the article that we published together, and they would range in dollars from $900 to $18,000. And we compare that to the average monthly wage in Albania, which is only $463. So the fines would be exorbitant and would muscle the media by publishing anything, and this is the problem, right? Anything that this commission decides is not genuine, impartial, or objective. And that's a bigger point of freedom of expression, which is who gets to decide what is genuine, impartial, and objective. The United States has, in some ways, through the First Amendment, figure that no one is worthy or even wise enough to decide what is good news or fake news or truth or true or false or genuine, impartial, and objective. And so they have elected.
Exactly. I mean, what is objective for you is not objective for
exactly.
me. So who can decide on that?
Right. And so the United States has developed a free speech jurisprudence, which is very different from the rest of the world. And we can talk about that now or later. But it's definitely worrisome because it would imply that this commission, which let's not get too carried out because
Well, one thing that worries me as well.
I just wanted to say that in the United States, there's also a Federal Communication Commission, right, which is also elected in some way. And they decide, like, for example, that you can't use bad words in TV broadcasting, right? And so for some, one word such as, I don't know, shit, for example, if I'm not mistaken, couldn't be used in TV broadcast, which is a different thing. But it's a way that governments have found to control and regulate communications. And it's not necessarily bad, but there is, and this is what we're pointing out, a lot of potential for violation, specifically when we've already seen that the prime minister or the ruling party have used these types of laws, and they're trying to amend it to be able to persecute journalists further.
Yes, and one thing that worries me about the fines is that the principle of proportionality is not applied in imposing these fines. So even if it's a big media outlet or a small media outlet with only two or three journalists with a really small budget, the fines would be the same.
Right. No, and that, yeah. That's exactly right. And I looked at General Comment 34 from the Human Rights Committee, which is a committee that examines the ICCPR. And actually, in paragraph 42, it actually says fines for being critical of the government are not permitted. And then it goes through a four-prong test on when you can limit free expression.
Yes.
And then not only is there a four-prong test, which is what you just mentioned, which is proportional, necessary, not overbroad,
yes,
and least intrusive. There's also a four-part test to when you make a law, right? The rationale for making a law limits freedom of expression has to be demonstrated in a specific and individualized fashion, and it has to have a direct and immediate connection, which what you're doing, you're seeking to do. And so the law doesn't seem to meet, from what I read in the translation that you did, a specific and individualized fashion and a direct immediate connection to the harm that is being alleged. Right? It only says broadly not to violate the dignity.
Well, it's especially when the law is supposed to tackle fake news and disinformation, which it definitely does. It doesn't, which, as far as we see in the law.
Exactly. So it definitely goes against paragraph 42 of comment 34, and the four rationales are not demonstrated completely, and we're not seeing the legitimate purpose, and it seems overbroad. The fines are not applied proportional, and it doesn't seem to be the least intrusive way to regulate fake news. So, as you said at the beginning, it's now under the review by the Venice Commission. Hopefully, it would be under review of the Constitutional Court of Albania, which is another story, and hopefully that's up and running soon. But it is very worrisome, and I was very happy to work with you and learn so much about Albania, about publishing this article, and hopefully moving the needle a little bit of why this is so worrisome.
Yes, exactly. So, Pedro, okay, we understand, we can understand that the law, it's not good, and what's the purpose of that law. But what is very concerning, at least for me, is the fact that many people back in Albania seem to be supportive of the government's initiative to pass this law. So in their heads, the press is a wrongdoer. And I believe this comes from disinformation and lack of knowledge on the subject matter. But could you elaborate on the threat that these policies pose, long-term speaking, not only to the press, but also to the rule of law and democracy of a country?
Yeah, it's a difficult question, because in some ways, sometimes the press is either negligent or it's very tied to political power, right? And so we cannot absolve the press of any wrongdoing, but the question is when it has gone too far, right? And of course, the principle still holds that no one is wise enough to know exactly when it goes too far. The United States has created a very special jurisprudence. It only has, let's say, seven categories which are not permitted in terms of free speech. But the question is, what we're really asking is how to create a vibrant civil society, right? How to empower citizens to get information, how to trust the media, a question about media literacy. In some ways, hopefully, this is a rebirth of that civil society, which holds the government to account, and it realizes that to hold the government to account, they must have a free press, and to have a free press, they cannot permit the government with an unelected commission to impose disproportionate fines on journalists. So long-term speaking, this will always be the fight. This will never end, right? Today, there are many lawsuits against Trump. There's lawsuits against journalists in the United States all the time. One recent example, which is very worrisome, but also really interesting, is the one about Gawker, which was backed by a billionaire, Peter Thiel. And they bankrupted Gawker for publishing what some considered to be in the public interest, but it was a private video. It was related to Hulk, the wrestler. And they shut it down. Gawker was shut down by a lawsuit, and it was a lawsuit that I understand was short forum shopped. So they sued in different states until they found an amenable jurisdiction. And some people speculate, and I don't know if this is true, is because Gawker outed this billionaire without his consent of being gay. And so he retaliated by suing them until they took it down. So this happens all the time. This is a fight that we must always persevere, because it is in that clash and in that tension that we hold both journalists and government to account. And so as we end that piece, we talk about how freedom of expression has very strange bedfellows. And one story which is forgotten that I wanted to tell is the story of Aryeh Nair. Aryeh Nair is a Holocaust survivor. He's Jewish. He rose to fame by being the head of the ACLU director. And there's this famous story which is not replicated anymore. People forget. There was a neo-Nazi march planned in Skokie, Illinois. And it was allegedly planned in Skokie, Illinois, because Skokie had the highest concentration of Jewish Holocaust survivors. And the neo-Nazi party of the United States wanted to march through the town with swastikas and weapons as a sign of intimidation. And Aryeh Nair, who was a Holocaust survivor himself, he was Jewish, he said, "You know, as long as they don't incite violence or create violence, I'm going to march with them to ensure that they don't incite violence, because I think their right to march and protest peacefully is a right that makes, to unfortunate turn of phrase, America great." But he did that, and he was very lauded, and he went on to become the president of the Open Societies Foundation. He's still alive. He's one of the eminences of the human rights movement. That distinction, that you support the rights of the people you most disagree with, as long as they're not violent, is missing, right? And all this story is to respond to your question about how to create a vibrant civil society, and it comes with a culture, right? It becomes with a way of thinking about people who hold different views. And I listened to your first episode, which is very enlightening, because Daniel talked about how there's such a great respect for others in Albania, but at the same time, people are very stubborn. Yes. But that seems to be the perfect place, right, to create a vibrant free speech culture. And so hopefully people can realize what happens with these laws. And sadly, usually it's always after the fact, right? It's only after the president and the prime minister imposes laws, journalists are fired, people don't get information, they rise up, they change the political parties, and hopefully they don't go overboard again and then make laws that are suitable for their own political parties, and they create a culture. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that would be a start.
Yes, I mean, I totally agree with your points. So if we want to change the situation, what should the standard of protection be with regard to press freedom, in your opinion, in a country like Albania?
So I don't think they should adopt any of the aforementioned standards just because they're European or American or hopefully never the Soviet Union standard. But they must come up with their own. But I think the reality is that they will adopt the European press freedom standards because they want to join the European Union, and the European Union will press them on that, and be very, very strange for a country that wants to join the European Union to adopt an American standard, right? And say, okay, here you can come to Albania and deny the Holocaust, and that would be very strange. So I think they will adopt an European press film standard. And if you allow me just a little tangent to talk about the European film standard, because I don't think it's perfect. So there's just two cases that I wanted to bring up from the European Court of Human Rights, which have this famous margin of appreciation. And so in one case in Turkey, where a young student wanted to wear a headscarf to an exam and she was banned from doing so, she sued the government and went all the way to the European Court of Human Rights. And the court says, yes, that's correct. You can ban the use of headscarves in a Muslim minority country. So Turkey was like, okay, great, we're a secular nation. Then in Switzerland, which is not a Muslim majority country, there were two girls who were forced to take mandatory swimming lessons with boys. And in the Muslim religion, young girls are not permitted to mingle without covering and in the swimming pool. So the parents refused to take the young girls to this mandatory swimming lessons from the Swiss government. They were fined. I think it was like 1,000 or 2,000 francs, which you can argue if it's exorbitant or not. The parents sued. It went all the way to the European Convention. They sued with the European Convention, went all the way up to the European Court of Human Rights, and the European Court of Human Rights says, yes, that is correct. You can be forced to take off, not the burqa. So it's a very strange thing, right? But at the same time, it provides that margin of appreciation, which in some ways is very valuable for countries to decide by themselves within some limits what freedom of expression standards they want to use. But it's when freedom of expression bleeds into freedom of religion, it's just complicated. So there's another case from the European Court of Justice where a private Belgian firm was allowed to prohibit a female receptionist from wearing a hijab on the grounds, and this is what's important, that the firm had an unwritten rule that disallowed employees from visible displays of their beliefs. Right? Unwritten rule.
Yes.
And so this went all the way up to the European Court of Justice, and it said, yep, that's okay. And the European Court said that the rule wasn't direct discrimination because it's not based on religion. But that sounds very strange to an American.
It is strange.
It sounds very strange from an American, because an American court would ask where, if the rule was written, if it was invented to ban the hijab, and if it was, or if it was just a veiled attempt to ban the hijab, which most people suspect these things are, right? People say like, oh, no,
yes,
religious things, but people know that it's about Muslims. So that makes it religious discrimination. And it would only have allowed such a ban if it was part of a bona fide occupational qualification for the job, which would only be the case, and I'm citing here to Noah Feldman, who wrote about it in Bloomberg, it would only be the case for a hair model, right? That's it.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, to get back to what standard Albania should use, I think it should develop its own standard. I think it has very particular considerations, as any country. And as you know, laws, even if they're written in the best manner possible, they're still abused. And what is important at the same time as a law is also a culture of free speech. So hopefully it seems like a really good place because of the stubbornness and the tolerance that is in Albania to have a really good free speech standard. So hopefully that'll be the case.
Well, yeah, those two elements definitely needs to be considered,
yeah,
when establishing a standard in Albania. But Pedro, so for the sake of argument, let's assume that the law is abolished. Like, let's assume that the Venice Commission is like, this is a bad law, it shouldn't go through. So what would you suggest the civil society and other parties of interest, including the journalists here, freelance journalists especially, to advocate for in adopting the new law? Because the government at one point will have to adapt a new law, and at that point the civil society will jump in to make sure that the government stays within the framework, within the suggestions of the Venice Commission. So what should they ask for?
Yeah, well, that's an issue that's been debated all around the world. It seems to be sadly in the hands of private companies like Facebook and Twitter to decide what is fake news and not, which seems to be the pressing issue. But also, I think, just to get back to the American standard, there's one law, right, in the United States, the First Amendment, and it only says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of the press. That's all it says, right? But of course, there's hundreds of laws about freedom of the press, and there's at least seven categories which are prohibited: obscenity, fighting words, defamation, perjury, blackmail, sort of incitement to imminent lawless action, true threats, and commercial speech. So that's eight, because blackmail, that's an interesting one. But it's the American system is famous for two main things. One, the standard for defamation, which is higher than most countries, and that's the famous case of New York Times v. Sullivan. And the other one is for incitement to violence, which is the Brandenburg test, which is the 1961 case. And I can go quickly through them if you want. I don't know if it relates too much.
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
Yeah. So let's go first to the Brandenburg, because it's about incitement to lawless action, which is, you know, Article 20 in the ICCPR and Comment 34, which you cannot. Just to read it again, Article 20 is any advocacy of national, racial, or religious hatred that constitutes incitement to discrimination, hostility, or violence shall be prohibited by law. So that's prohibited in the ICCPR. I understand, if I remember correctly, that the U.S. lodged a reservation and it doesn't apply neither this nor any that conflicts with U.S. law. But that case is a very interesting case because it's a horrible set of facts. It was the members of the KKK, which is this famous white supremacist, racist and terrorist organization, that in this case in 1965 was holding a rally in an open field far away from everyone, where they burned a cross, which was a sign of racial incitement. And they make a speech famously calling for revengeance, which of course is not correct. It's revenge or vengeance, but they call it revengeance against African Americans. And in this case, the person who had made this speech and participated in this rally was fined, put in prison. He appealed it all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, no, that's not correct. We can't fine him. We can't pull him in jail for burning a cross or calling for revengeance. What we're going to do is create a new test, which is called the Brandenburg test, in which you both have to direct to incite or producing imminent lawless action. It has to be direct and has to be imminent, and it is likely to incite or produce such action. So you could, in this case, you could argue that he directed inciting imminent lawless action, the revengeance, but it was unlikely to happen because there were no African Americans running. It was the middle of a field. But of course, people say, but come on, you know, this is the KKK. What do you think they were doing? Just, you know, making a parody. So that's the Brandenburg test, which is very interesting. It doesn't occur in a lot of places because it has of that two prongs that it is likely to happen, but it is very fact specific. And it provides that any laws has to be meet all the requirements, the four requirements that we talked about before. More important for journalists, which is what we're talking about, is the New York Times versus Sullivan case. And just to recount the facts, it's a press freedom case. So the New York Times published a full page ad by supporters of Martin Luther King, which were criticizing the police chief in Montgomery County. It was not vetted by the New York Times. It was published by the supporters of Martin Luther King. And the Montgomery chief sued. He's like, you're defaming me, this is not true. And what is interesting is that there were at least three false assertions in the ad, right? And the supporters weren't sued, it was the New York Times which had published it. So the three false things were the number of times that Dr. King had been arrested, what song the protesters had sung, and whether or not the students had been expelled for participating. That was fake news. The New York Times was sued, and the Montgomery police chief, which was identified by name, said it was defaming him because he was responsible for controlling the protests. and he won all the way until it went up to the Supreme Court. And until that point, he would have won, right? Because it was defamatory. They were saying that the Montgomery police chief was reckless, or was like he didn't know what he was doing, and it was damaging his reputation. But they weren't suing the police chief, right? That's what we must remember. They were suing the New York Times. And the court said, no, wait a minute. The press can publish anything they want about a public figure, as long, and this is where they come up with a new test, it doesn't show a reckless disregard for the truth or actual malice, right? So here in the United States, and this doesn't happen almost anywhere in the world, you can publish almost anything about a public figure. Private figures are different, as long as it's not intentionally reckless or there's actual malice. So you can publish a lot of stuff, which is good, but at the same time,
which means that our politicians back in Albania wouldn't be able to go to court so easily if we apply the same standards.
Right, but there would be more fake news.
Yeah, probably.
Right? So this is the tension what I was talking about before. But it is an interesting standard. I think what I would encourage activists in Albania is to protect the freedom of the press by any means possible, right? In the sense that all these things happen because, in this case, the New York Times refused to cave in, right? It also happened in the Pentagon Papers, where the Washington Post and New York Times published the Vietnam Papers, and they told them not to publish them, and they refused, right? There's a tradition of maintaining that independence. And we must remember that the United States jurisprudence is not something that harkens back to the founding fathers. I think there's a case from 1850s where someone was put in jail because he defamed Christianity, because he blasphemed and defamed Christianity. This happened. There's an excellent book, I can't remember the name, about this. These two guys that, one that ended up in the Supreme Court, Learned Hand, which is the best name for a judge ever. And Oliver Wendell Holmes, and how they created this free speech jurisprudence, which in some ways it's unique, and it has created this really vibrant society. But at the same time, the European standards are usually good, and any help that activists and journalists can get from the Venice Commission or the Europeans are great, being careful to not be branded as agents of the Europeans or other place, right? You have to really come up with this yourself, right? You cannot depend all the time on the Venice Commission, because it loses legitimacy. Like, a lot of people say, like, okay, why should we believe the Venice Commission and not our prime minister, right? He knows more about this, so let's create that constitutional court, let's figure out the corruption in the court, and let's find a way for journalists to preserve that freedom of speech and freedom of the press in a legitimate way. So that would be my two cents.
Well, exactly. What worries me a lot is the independence of the regulatory body, like the body that will implement the law. So I don't know if you would agree with me that we need a self-regulation of the press in Albania. It's for the journalists to have a body that decide about their colleagues, whether what they wrote is wrong or right. I don't know what your opinion
is.
Yeah,
we've talked about this before, and we need to do more research, because I still don't understand what self-regulation means more than an association of journalists that police themselves by saying, for example, there's a l'Association de la Presse Étrangère in Paris has all these, and I only know about this because I work there. It's an association of all the foreign journalists in Paris, and they hold events, and they give each other contacts and networks. And of course, if someone publishes something that is completely wrong, they'll be like, hey, like, you know, where are you getting this information? And sort of police themselves by either publishing another article or helping this colleague write it better, or giving him better sources, giving him or her better sources. So that would be one way. The other way, I think, is it's just letting, and this is an American idea, and there's very different variations of it, the marketplace of idea, right? But the media regulates itself through the marketplace of ideas. So only if people are finding the news newsworthy and reliable and accurate are they going to keep buying the media. And so we let media companies fail if they don't achieve that, which is the market playing a role. But of course, it can be manipulated. But I don't know exactly what to say about self-regulation. I think, of course, there must be self-regulation. I think freedom of speech is both a responsibility and a right, but one must be very careful, because one can also imagine that this body of journalists could also decide what is good or not. And so it happens a lot in countries in the Islamic countries, there's this case of Raif al-Badawi, who published a manuscript about liberalizing Saudi Arabia. And of course, this was the crown. It's an absolutist monarchy. It's despotic. It's terrible. And they put in prison lashes, I think 1,000 lashes. But you could imagine the same thing coming from a council of conservative Muslims or Christians or Jews or whomever, right? It's not about that they're Muslim or anything, saying, oh, no, in this society, we think that, you know, I don't know, that that anyone who says anything about the coronavirus shutdown has to be imprisoned. And so no one can be like, hey, I you know, all this discussion right now going on about lockdowns and until when are they necessary? Like, if no one can diverge from the consensus because a committee says so, then you don't have free speech, actually, right? So John Stuart Mill used to say that freedom of speech is not only for the one who speaks, but also for the one who listens. Because if you're deprived of even one view, you're not getting the full picture. And so he faithfully said that if everyone agreed but one, we should still hear that one, because maybe we wouldn't be right. We wouldn't know we were correct if we didn't listen to that one. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, that actually is a great point of view, if you think about it. So, Pedro, before we come to an end of this episode, So we are living in crazy times right now with the COVID pandemic around. So do you think that this situation will contribute into the deterioration of the press?
Well, in some ways it already has, right? We've seen Orban in Hungary ruling by decree. A state of emergencies have been declared all around the world. And I was listening to Anne Applebaum and Garry Kasparov in this conference called CovidCon the other day. And I think it was there that they made the joke, the old Soviet joke, actually, which is there's nothing more permanent than a temporary solution. Which, you know, you can limit the freedom of the press specifically and exactly how the international standards in Article 19 and 20 of the ICCPR say, and say, hey, it's only temporary. And then after the crisis ends, they'll remain in place. That's a pessimistic view. Another optimistic view is that it might energize more people to find out what is true and what is not. Because when it comes to the pandemic, you want to know numbers. You want to know whether China is reporting its number, where they appeared, whether it appeared in a lab, as some people are claiming, probably completely falsely, but hopefully get enough evidence to get to the bottom of that. But at least, you know, that opinion is aired, that can be investigated. And so maybe it'll make a resurgence for people wanting to learn more about how the media, how the sausage is made, right? There's this conception in media that if you knew how the sausage is made, you wouldn't want to eat it. And by that, they mean that if you knew how journalism was made, you wouldn't consume it. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that this age of social media is creating a new paradigm where we want to know how information is produced, because we ourselves in some way little reporters, right? We have to find out whether something that we see on Twitter, on Facebook is true or not. And so I always come back to this analogy about the printing press in 1452, I think, which is the printing press. I think, and this is not a complete historical analogy because I haven't looked at these facts in a long time, but imagine if when the printing press was invented, people started thinking, and I think exactly as they think now, monks that had been working painstakingly with illuminated manuscripts, and this is the repository of knowledge, this is what are true, and suddenly someone comes along and prints 92 theses, puts them on a wall, they get disseminated all over Europe, and he creates, this Martin Luther creates the Great Schism, right? It splits the church. For the church, that was the worst fake news that ever existed. But for the Lutherans, it's not fake news, right?
Yes.
We may be entering a new period of press. It's not press freedom, but press a new era of the press. In that, like just now, like before, when someone in a position of power spoke, they had a megaphone, right? They could speak, and they had the biggest quotes in the newspapers and the TVs, and the little guy or the little woman who couldn't fight back. But now Trump tweets, or someone from Korea and Ecuador tweets, and anyone can tweet back, and that tweet occupies exactly the same space, right? If you're looking at it visually, there's nothing to tell you which one you should listen to more, whether Trump or Korea or you or whomever. And of course, there's a lot of comments and fake news and conspiracy, but in some ways we've equalized the power relationship, at least visually, right? The same way that Trump has to create a Twitter account, you have to create it as well. This crisis, as any other crisis, is a place where nothing changes and everything will change. We must always be vigilant. Freedom of the press is always for these situations and for all situations. It's an ever-changing process, right? It's not like one day you realize that freedom of the press is important and then you're like, okay, we drafted a law, it's good. Like, you must fight for it every day. You must fight for it every time the government wants you to reveal a source where they cite national security concerns. And I think one of the most powerful tools, and maybe we'll finish with this, is humor or satire. And we pointed this out in the piece, and I wish we had explored it more in the piece we published together, but the current Prime Minister of Albania, Edi Rama, himself was beaten up because of his own critical writings, right? In 1997, I think, right? So if you throw that back into his face and say, hey, come on, like, what, you like getting people beat? Like, why is it different when you're in power? And you expose the contradictions and like hypocrisy, I think one can create a better model.
Yes, it's true indeed. And as you said right now, and also as you said in our role, that like we will remain vigilant on this. So thank you, Pedro, for being with me.
No,
really appreciate.
Thank you, obviously it's fascinating. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to what you do with this podcast and with your work. And I've been. I admire your entrepreneurship, your writing ability, and your clear thinking about all these issues. So thanks for having me, and I look forward to more episodes.
Thank you, Pedro.
Right, bye.